welcome to the members' room of the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, and it's so wonderful to have you all here tonight for our New York City Book Awards. It's great to have our trustees, staff, library members, publishers, and of course our winning authors, their family, and friends. All of you who have come to celebrate a great New York tradition and a great Society Library tradition, the New York City Book Awards. This is really one of our most special celebrations of the year, so you've picked tonight to come and join us. For those of you who don't know about this library, it's now 261 years young. We are the oldest surviving library and cultural institution in the city, founded in 1754. This library is open to all for reading, reference, and many events, and our circulation and other services are available to members of the library. This is a landmark building, and it houses over 300,000 books, and we have open stacks. We have lots of rare books, as you would imagine, and we provide reading rooms, study spaces, a wonderful children's library, and we hold exhibitions in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery, which you walked through when you came in the building. I really want to express my thanks to Ellen Eisman, our library trustee, for her generosity in underwriting the awards, and to Jenny Lawrence for her ongoing support of the Hornblower Award. So thank you, Ellen, and thank you, Jenny. It's my pleasure now to welcome Lucienne Bloch. Lucienne is a member of our library. I'm not going to tell you when she joined. You'll have to ask her that. But she's been a very loyal member, and she is our very steady-handed and accomplished chair of the New York City Book Awards jury. So, Lucienne.
Thanks, Mark. So, I'm going to repeat just a bit of what Mark said. Welcome to everyone who's come to celebrate the Society Library's Book Awards for 2014. Thank you, Ellen, for funding these awards, and Jenny Lawrence for the ongoing support of the Hornblower Award, which is given for first publication in book form. I thank the award winners for their fine and important books about New York City and the people who live in it. And I want to applaud my fellow jurors, whose enthusiasm, hard work, expertise, and keen sensibilities made our meetings informative and very lively. You all made important contributions to the decisions leading to this ceremony. Please stand as I read your names. James Atlas, Andrew Dolkart, Ella Fauché, Bobby Lee, Jean Parker Pfeiffer, Peter Salwin, Warren Wexler, and Meg Wolitzer. Five of our jurors will be presenting awards this evening. Of course, the jury couldn't have done its work without guidance from Mark Bartlett and the tireless help of Sarah Holliday and Katie Frickas. Again, my thanks to all of you. Last year, I spoke about the astonishing number of books that the jury reads during a period of 8 months. This year, I want to tell you about the many kinds of books we read. I should mention that we have few requirements for the books we consider, the central one being that a book shed some new or unusual light on New York City and its unique spirit, thereby changing or enhancing our understanding of this complex city and its residents. The work must exist in tangible book form, be copyrighted in the year of the award, and be of high interest and quality. Multiple author books or anthologies, reprints, guidebooks, cookbooks, or statistical reference books are not eligible. Occasionally, as we are doing this year, we give a special citation of merit to a body of work about New York published over several years. We consider all genres of literary, popular, and academic books, including biography, history, fiction, memoir, politics, architecture and design, political history, art, poetry, photography, social science, essays, natural history, environmental and ecological studies, immigration, economics, engineering, children's and young adult, mystery, transportation, true crime, linguistics, graphic fiction and nonfiction, sports, and more sorts of books that come to our attention in today's expanding universe of subject matter and ways of treating it. Now it is my pleasure to present Ellen Eisman, a longtime member of the library's board.
Good evening, and thank you, Lucienne, for that kind introduction. For 5 years now, I've sponsored these awards, prompted by my love for books, for New York City, my birthplace, and where I grew up and lived for most of my adult life, and for this library. When I was thinking about this occasion, I realized that I wanted to touch on the essence of this institution and what has bound me to it. Many of you here may feel the same way. I hope that my remarks will resonate with you. First, a bit about how I came to know the New York Society Library. It was as a young high schooler whose terrific school at the time had a limited science book collection. I was in ninth grade studying biology, and I had two term papers due, one on Parkinson's disease and one on mononucleosis. My mother, a journalist who had used the library for her work and also for pleasure, suggested that I try out the library to find the reference books lacking at my school. The idea worked like a charm. I found a trove of information here on the two topics and even got a comment from my science teacher. It was amazing for me to get any kind of good grade in science. But handwritten at the top, it said, "Super research. You have really delved into the subject matter." I later joined the library again as a young mother and brought our toddler son to the celebration of the library's 250th anniversary. He made it onto the newsletter anniversary cover, as I recall, in a photo shot where he watched a weaver dressed for colonial Dutch times doing a demonstration of her art. We started to attend more and more children's events and began taking books out of the children's library. Life was coming full circle. As a board member and frequent borrower of library books, I'm often in this building. As I enter, I feel the library's long history and a respect for that history is manifested in the exhibits, in the way the building is kept in shape, in the efforts to signal the library's ongoing role in the city, a part it has played dating back to when New York was briefly the nation's capital and George Washington was president. The book awards exemplify this spirit, a celebration of recent works that reflect and in their different ways honor New York and in turn get honored by the library. I can't think of a more worthy endeavor to stand behind, especially as the publishing world is gutted every day a bit more. I'm honored to be associated with this year's new books of such high quality. I'm so glad my wonderful mother sent me down here as a 14-year-old to go into the stacks. To this day, the library still serves as a helpful resource to thousands and as an oasis for serious intellectual pursuit. Thanks so much for coming tonight.
About 40 years ago, I was cheerfully immersed in a new book by Elizabeth Barlow, The Forests and Wetlands of New York City. And one of that book's many delights was the expressions of disbelief it tended to elicit from people who happened to notice what I was reading. Wetlands? Forests? New York City? Must be a short book. Well, today there's a much wider understanding that our great city actually exists within a natural environment, but for many of us, I think Ted Steinberg's book will increase that understanding by an order of magnitude. To begin with, as an ecological historian, he has an obvious and deep affection for the vanished landscape that was once the New York archipelago, an area that in Peter Stuyvesant's day encompassed 55 different ecological communities, from low salt marshes to blueberry bogs to majestic oak tulip forests, all teeming with wildlife. But the city's ecological history, he tells us, the short version, is the story of how an estuary with a high natural density was replaced by one with an astonishingly high unnatural density, that is, 60 or 70,000 human beings per square mile. The unbound Gotham of his title is a greater New York that's existed in the plans and imaginations of generations of merchants, financiers, real estate operators, and others who, for 400 years, have believed and acted as though there were literally no limits to the city's possible growth. Thanks to their energy and enterprise, New York has been engaged since the 1600s in a vast land reclamation project that has turned tens of thousands of acres of supposedly worthless swamps and wetlands into valuable real estate, in large part by dumping our trash there. Steinberg gives us a detailed ecological account of how the metropolitan area evolved, a process he calls one of the most creative acts of vandalism ever perpetrated on a natural landscape. But along the way, he also introduces us to a long and entertaining parade of egomaniacs who have tampered with the city's shorelines and waters, including one of my favorites, the surveyor James E. Sorrell, who seriously proposed to cut a new East River through Queens and fill up the old channel. We also meet a few engaging folks like James Ruel Smith, an enthusiastic amateur who tried to bicycle to and photograph every spring and well on Manhattan Island 100 years ago, and Willie Royka, who was making a living trapping muskrats in the New Jersey meadowlands in the 1970s. He also provides a host of minor historical insights, the kind I especially enjoy. I appreciated learning, for instance, that Sheepshead Bay was named for a fish that preyed on oysters and clams, and that Grover Whalen, New York's official greeter in the LaGuardia years, happened to be born on Grover Cleveland's wedding day, or that Secaucus comes from an Indian word that meant the place where the snakes hide. The lesson we need to take from New York's ecological history, Steinberg tells us, is the need to preserve as much wetland and unfragmented open space as possible, and perhaps even to entertain the idea of retreat, owning up to the limits imposed by life in an estuary. The book closes with a brief overview of some dangers confronting us, including earthquakes, extreme heat events, and the rising ocean levels, and a brief account of Superstorm Sandy and her aftermath when, as he puts it, the sea paid a little visit to New York, and New York seemed for a brief moment to have wound up nearly back where it started. That could have been what they now call a teachable moment. But despite a lot of positive-sounding language, like the Bloomberg administration's Vision 2020 plan, which talked about environmental protection, Steinberg doesn't seem to see much change in what he calls our arrogant stance toward land and sea. And he leaves us with a mighty disturbing question. Will those in charge of the real estate capital of the world, forever bent on increasing the value of land at all costs, find a way to adapt to the high water ahead? So for enlightening and entertaining us, and for scaring the hell out of us as we look to an uncertain future, I'm very happy to present this New York City Book Award to Professor Ted Steinberg. I just dropped it. There you go. Congratulations. Oh, absolutely.
Thank you very much for those very generous and comments. Robert Moses once wrote that New York is too big, too complex for any one writer. The old man had a point. Exhibit A. This book began so long ago that the Berlin Wall was still standing. Speaking of walls, it was a wall that helped me finally see the moral lesson of New York's relationship with the environment. When the September 11th disaster happened, I was drawn to thinking, what about the concrete retaining wall built around the foundation of the World Trade Center site? It was built to keep the Hudson River, which is about 200 feet or so, at bay. Would it hold? Well, as it turned out, it of course did. And it prompted one architect to write that the retaining wall, the structure, symbolized New York's invincible spirit. Well, I've given that wall a lot of thought. If the wall represented something invincible about New York, it also said something about the city's relationship with the surrounding waters, a desire to shut the door on them. Indeed, as it turned out, as I later learned, that retaining wall that I just mentioned, if it was going to be viewed as planned by visitors to the 9/11 Museum, was going to require its own retaining wall. That was the only way to ward off the brackish water lapping at this concrete manifestation of the city's supposed unconquerable spirit. As I got into the research, however, I realized that the powers that be in New York didn't just want to close the door on the ocean. They wanted to get right up in nature's face, to wade out, at times recklessly so, into the sea. Just last week, a chap called me about his plan for a sixth borough to be built smack in the middle of open water. A plan I characterized to him on the phone as great, but 100 years too late. Which is to say that it's not an accident that nearly half the city of New York, some 147 square miles, is in one of six hurricane evacuation zones. It's not fate, exactly, that explains why New York is vastly more vulnerable to coastal flooding than other major port cities, including London, Rotterdam, Tokyo, and even Shanghai. Decisions were made. Roads were taken or not taken. But mainly, it was, in my opinion, an economic order founded on the quest for limitless growth that explains why it is that the capital of capitalism is so uniquely prone to destruction. What Gotham Unbound has done for me personally is to raise a question in my mind, and it's this. Do those who love New York, who rule over it, love it enough to save it in a world of rising seas? That said, I should probably give a little nod here to old William Walton, whose experience is expanding the New York waterfront I discuss a bit in the book. I believe Walton was one of the people, not a founder, Mark tells me, but one of the people who was instrumental in the formation of the New York Society Library, and I dare say if it were not for him and others like him, I would not be here this evening. So, Bill, wherever you are, thank you. I want to thank my family and my research assistants, my colleagues, and my friends, some of whom are here this evening. These are people that have known me and supported me in my various intellectual escapades for some 30 years or more. I want to thank my literary agent, Joe Veltri at Gersh. He's the most genial man I know, and he's been a big league backer for years now. I must also acknowledge the work of Thomas Labine, my editor at Simon & Schuster. To this very day, Thomas Labine has stood rock solid behind this book, even though he has moved on to take another job in Boston. In his place here, however, tonight is Jonathan Cox from the Simon & Schuster Company, and Jonathan has done everything that an author could ask for. Jonathan, if I've learned anything writing this book, it's that trying to direct people's attention to the inconvenient truths of New York's ecological history is like trying to push a boulder up a hill, which is to say that I am doubly, triply grateful to be accepting this award this evening. And when I say thank you are going to have to believe me. I really mean thank you.
J.D. Salinger, The Escape Artist by Thomas Beller, is a biography and, as you'll soon hear, a memoir as well. To compose his original impressionistic portrait of a singular American writer, Mr. Beller visits pre-war Manhattan apartment houses where Salinger was raised, schools where Sonny, as his family called him, foundered in one way or another, parks where he played as a boy and ruminated as a young man, and finally Cornish, New Hampshire, where Salinger spent the later years of his very long life, attracting intense public attention to the end, even as he shunned it. Mr. Beller also cites distinguished editors and teachers who recognized and fostered Salinger's fresh, irresistible talent. He peruses Salinger's correspondence at the Morgan Library and rereads the short stories in Catcher in the Rye against their writer's life as he discerns it. This is a unique biography, neither exhaustive nor tightly documented, but concise, suggestive, speculative, haunting, and suffused with a sense of the mid-century New York that permeates what we know of Salinger's work.
That's the biography. I'm the memoir. Thomas Beller grew up in the same Manhattan milieu as J.D. Salinger. What makes The Escape Artist a memoir, as well as a biography, is that Beller demonstrates how his life and that of Salinger were intertwined, but not by time, but by place. In many ways, the early life of Salinger mirrored that of Beller as a young man. What's fascinating to all of us in the jury was New York is on every page. Grand Central Station, the Museum of Natural History, private school, the apartments, and above all, Central Park. Beller, who is a frequent contributor to The New Yorker, meticulously researched and wrote about the role of New Yorker editors and magazines in his own life, as well as Salinger's. Now I'm going to tell you about one tiny little incident in the book. One incident that Beller describes gives you some idea that the affection and understanding that Beller has for Salinger. I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit, so forgive me. 4-year-old Sonny, and that was what they called Salinger, Sonny, had a fight with his sister Doris. He packed his suitcase and dressed himself in his Indian outfit and left his apartment. A couple of hours later, his mother came home, arrived in the lobby, and saw her son in his Indian outfit wearing a feathered headdress with a suitcase by his side. Now I'm going to quote Beller as he quotes Salinger. Sonny says, "Mother, I am running away, but I stayed to say goodbye to you." One of my favorite things in the whole wonderful book. Richard Ford wrote that the distinguishing mark of literary greatness remains a fresh, sentence-level flair and a rigorous focus on the story at hand. With this biography memoir, Thomas Beller has done exactly that.
I'm very grateful to get this, and it's such a generosity on the part of the library, this magnificent place. And if I may, I want to thank a few people and make a couple of remarks. The first I want to address to Ted, my fellow recipient, that the sixth borough of the city, I feel, has been already designated. It's New Orleans, Louisiana. That's a personal opinion. Very unpopular in New Orleans, but I don't shy away from sharing it. Another thing I want to mention is that, Ellen, it was very interesting to hear your anecdote about your science paper and that you were, you know, benefited from this resource, this library. I had to think immediately of my ninth grade science paper, which took place, the research, I should say, in Mid-Manhattan Library, which you may know in comparison to this institution is sort of Port Authority. What went wrong is only my fault, but I do want to say that things did go wrong. I somehow got it into my head that I would take notes on this something about a dinosaur in National Geographic, and I carefully numbered all these index cards and then went home and typed them all up in the same order, which Dr. Shostak, my science teacher, thought made it seem to resemble the article I was taking notes on, rather. But I allow myself that because the author I was asked to write about is someone who was really preoccupied with childhood in his own writing and who made use of personal catastrophes, both sort of comic and more serious. And inevitably, I started to think about my own experiences juxtaposed against his, and there was some tension about how much I should let of my own life into this book, and it seemed a bit unseemly to do so, although that turned out not to be an inhibiting factor. If I may, in a kind of like Academy Award sort of way, just rattle off some names that I wrote down, because there are many people were remarkably, how many pockets do I have to look at, helpful, supportive in this. So just to go quickly down a list, and by helpful and supportive, I mean to talk to me. Adrian Benepi, Roger Bellin, Nick Perufo, Nancy Franklin, Dottie Lebrano, Roger Angel. Special mention to Jonathan Ames. I did a lot of research in Princeton, and Ames had gone to Princeton. At one point, in a state of distress, I got on the phone with him on the train in Princeton, and we spoke all the way into the tunnel into Manhattan. It was kind of beautiful. It was dusk. Jonathan was incredible, taking phone calls at all times. Also important to mention is Ed Park, the editor at Amazon, who oversaw this. My agent, Mary Evans, my beautiful wife, Elizabeth, who was extremely supportive and allowed me to just disappear and survived my own expressions of anxiety as the book was being written. But the person I wanted to focus on most closely is my editor, James Atlas. There's a sort of reference to a comic situation in the book, which I'm probably giving away too much, but I talk about having been given this precious manuscript, this special book that no one had ever seen. You know, it wasn't in the end published, it was pulped, but here was a rare specimen. And in my book, I discussed that there was this terrible setback when I lost this special thing. What I don't go into is that the special thing that I had lost had belonged to my editor, James Atlas. So this kind of set me back in the beginning of my book, and I finally had this epiphany that having lost this special thing was actually an indication of all the resistance I had to the project, and that the resistance might be interesting as a subject. And I actually wrote this all in, I thought, a very expressive letter that was a breakthrough moment for me, which I sent by email right before getting on a plane. And then I landed and checked my voicemail to hear my editor, James Atlas, saying, "Let's just cancel the whole thing." So I called him up and I said, "Well, now wait one moment." And the amazing thing is that wasn't the last proposal of cancellation in the whole project. But this is now time to really acknowledge this incredible act of patience, artistic, editorial artistry, tolerance, not consistent, but... that James Atlas bestowed upon me in editing this book. And I want to share two brief anecdotes to end it. Such is the nature of these things that by the time we finished, some time had gone by, and I wrote him a note saying, "I miss our crises." And he wrote me back, "Just wait." And the other thing I want to share is from a cab right over here. So in addition to writing about childhood in his fiction, the issue of his own childhood was a big deal with Salinger. That's a big part of my book. And as has been mentioned, my childhood sort of topographically overlapped a bit. So I do generally believe that one shouldn't share anecdotes before you write them down, because then it somehow gets in the way of the composition process. You kind of give it away. But this ethic of mine has now been challenged by the fact that I'm going to forget it anyway. So I want to tell you this exchange I had with my mother in the taxi over here. And I said, Mom, I said, I think this tie might be my dad's tie. And I showed it to her, and I said, yeah, I think it might be. And then I said, well, I might be wrong. And she goes, you might be right.
Hi. One of the problems with choosing what novel to read next is that you never know in advance whether a book will feel essential or inessential. There's no royal taster for fiction. Critics can sometimes be helpful, but they don't entirely count because they aren't you, you with your tastes and your needs. So you simply have to try it. Some books reveal their urgency slowly, and others do it quickly. Atticus Lish's novel, Preparation for the Next Life, is one of the quick revealers. Virtually immediately upon beginning it, I felt in the presence of something unusual, which came through in the fluidity of the prose, as in this passage. In the motel, they kept the TV running to practice English. They squatted on the carpet, moving their mouths in the blue light, seeing the grocery store aisles and the fast cars. Unbelievable, they said. This Tuesday on Fox, a grim day in Iraq. She watched goggled soldiers and radio antennas driving past adobe houses in the desert, which she had lived in. Camel, she pointed. The animal, it's very good. Too hard, they said. It can't be absorbed. Mind is a wooden plank. Someone yawned. Have to practice it a lifetime. The novel is the story of a woman, Zhou Lei, a Chinese immigrant and ethnic Uyghur from northwest China who is adrift and isolated in New York City, having experienced terrible deprivation and poverty and imprisonment by the U.S. government. She meets Skinner, also adrift, a veteran of the Iraq War, lost, suffering greatly from post-traumatic stress disorder. That these two, both having experienced really so much pain, can actually find and experience love is only one moving aspect of this novel. How they come together and the shield they desperately try to place over themselves like a thin mosquito netting against all the world's ills is at the heart of this breathtakingly good and tragic New York story. I say New York story because the city is, of course, very present here, and parts of it that I've rarely seen written about before. But while they feel so accurate to me, Lish creates a cartography of hidden corners that you can almost not bear to look at, but you do, because you know that people live in them, and Lish's people live in them. Like many readers, I first became aware of this book when the critic Dwight Garner, writing in the New York Times in November, opened his review with the following. Atticus Lish's first novel is unlike any American fiction I've read recently in its intricate comprehension of and deep feeling for life at the margins. This is an intense book with a low fly-specked center of gravity. It's about blinkered lives, scummy apartments, dismal food, bad options. At its knotty core, amazingly, is perhaps the finest and most unsentimental love story of the new decade. It's one that builds slowly in intensity like a shaft of sunlight into an anthracite mine. It's funny, I almost think that the good writing in preparation for the next life makes reviewers want to rise to the occasion and be lyrical themselves in their reviews. And this review was followed by many others, and the novel was subsequently given the 2015 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, the Carla Furstenberg Cohen Literary Prize, and it was named a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award for Debut Fiction. And I actually have to add on a personal note, there was something called the Literary Deathmatch in L.A., where sort of writers kind of are judged in very ironic and satirical ways, and Atticus Lish won that as well, and I happen to know because I was a judge. But on a much more serious note, we're really happy to once again honor Atticus Lish and his thrillingly good and, yes, essential novel. So, congratulations.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. This is a great honor. My deepest thanks to the New York Society Library for this recognition. Predating American independence, the library has witnessed so much of the evolution of this great city, which has driven the American economy and culture for nearly 300 years. As the gears of this massive engine screamed and grinded, the library protected our books and gave a temporary haven to people who wanted to come in out of the noise and heat to read and think. I wrote my book in New York. The book takes place mainly in New York, so thank you, New York. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank my publisher, Giancarlo DiTrapano, founder of the small press Tyrant Books. GN fulfilled for me what is every writer's most desperate desire after completing his or her novel, to get his or her novel published, and published the way I wanted without butchering or distortion. You can't put a price on what GN has done for me, an unlikely conclusion to come to about any transaction that takes place in a city known for its cynicism as much for its grandeur. But GN is half maverick, half mystic, and I never would have met him anywhere but in New York. Through GN, I've had the privilege and pleasure to work with Lauren Sarand, an extraordinary publicist who exemplifies the New York spirit of professionalism, street smarts, and get up and go. Thank you to Lauren. Thank you to Amelia, a.k.a. Molly Atlas of ICM. To have access to Ms. Atlas's guidance and advocacy is to have rare good fortune as a writer. She, along with Amanda Urban, represent the upper reaches of the professional literary world, the kind of high-powered, high-stakes world one can only imagine finding in New York. I'd like to acknowledge my father, Gordon Lish, an acclaimed literary figure who has left his indelible stamp on American letters and who is also attending tonight. Since my book came out and he saw it, he has expressed his enthusiastic approval. Thank you, Gordon. Gordon, you are a New Yorker. My book is about a part of New York that feels a long way from this room. It's set in Flushing, Queens, out in the real world, the world this library provides a haven from. The neighborhood along the 7 subway line, the Flushing Corona Jackson Heights line, comprises one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the world. It is an immigrant neighborhood. As our city and our nation continue to evolve, the leading edge of that evolution, or one of the leading edges of that evolution, can be found with our immigrants. My heroine, Zole, is an immigrant, an Asian, who crosses international boundaries in search of a new life, and her quest is partly for economic freedom, but also for political freedom, to not be enslaved or imprisoned, as was mentioned before. New York nearly kills her. Freedom for nations and individuals and for individuals' imaginations will always require struggle. The woman who shares my struggle is Beth, my wife and girlfriend since 1990. People say New York is the center of the universe. That makes Beth New York to me. Thank you.
Good evening. I am here to present the Hornblower Award for a first book, and tonight that award goes to Catherine McNoor, who got her PhD as recently as 2012 from Yale University, and she is professor of environmental history and public history at Portland State University. She has also taught at NYU and the New School in New York. And I wanted to tell you about this wonderful book, which talks about the history of New York in a very different way than some of the books that we're familiar with. Books about the physical and ecological history of New York City have been all the rage in the last decade. You think of the Manhattan Project, the island at the center of the world, Gotham Unbound, and many others. What makes this book, Taming Manhattan, uniquely interesting is its focus on the role of productive agriculture, animal husbandry, and the use and misuse of water resources in the early life of New York City. From today's vantage point, we look through the lens of sustainability and resilience to view the continuum of our natural history. But Ms. McNoor looks back to the physical impact, the smells, the sounds, the look of agriculture and husbandry on the appearance of our city. We can hear the pigs grunting and defecating and running amok in the 18th century streets of the city, even the 19th century streets. Since only the rich could afford to pen and feed their animals on private lots, the poor were left to let their animals run wild, and they would scrounge for a free dinner from the refuse on the streets. And so there were many civic regulations to try to control this, but they were not always successful because they were largely dealing with social control as well as environmental control. And so these issues became intertwined in income inequality, and these issues we're very familiar with today. One of the subjects in the book that I found most interesting was the problem of how to dispose of all the manure that the horses generated. We learned that by 1835, there were over 10,000 horses in Manhattan, each of which produced 40 pounds of manure every day. Of course, these piles of manure smelled, they attracted flies, but it was a very valuable commodity because you could sell it to the farmers in Long Island who would grow the food for the city. And there was a euphemism back then, they called it nature's reciprocity system, which is a wonderful term. So this manure was extremely valuable, so valuable that there was a law that individuals were forbidden from selling or using the manure themselves. So the city would sell it, and they actually made back up to 75% of the cost of cleaning the streets by selling the manure. So while today we are fascinated by and enthusiastic about the environmental and health benefits of urban agriculture, the author explains how the authentic, smelly, messy agricultural uses that were still active in 19th century Manhattan were gradually eliminated in the civic interest by creating this idealized concept of rus in urbe in artfully designed amenities like Central Park. And thus it was around the time of the Civil War that productive agriculture was completely phased out of Manhattan and replaced by this sort of artificial abstraction of landscape as we remembered it, as this evocative memory of an idealized past. So it's a wonderful book. On the cover there are the pigs routing around in the dirt. So we recommend it to you. And to accept the award tonight, Catherine McNoor is not here, but Lisa LaPointe will accept the award for her.
Catherine couldn't be here this evening, but she is honored to receive this award, and as a fellow New York history buff, I'm happy to accept it for her. Thank you very much.
So, imagine New York without Grand Central Terminal, the New York Yacht Club, Forest Hills Gardens, the Knickerbocker and Colony Clubs, and the Tiffany Store. We know and love these buildings, even if we do not necessarily know the names of the architects who created them. It has been the task of architect Peter Pennoyer and historian Ann Walker to ensure that we do know who designed these buildings and to place these buildings in the context of their architects' careers and in the context of architecture and design in New York City in the early 20th century. The award we are giving to Peter Pennoyer and Ann Walker is a bit different from the awards that the Society has given in recent years, including tonight. It goes not to an individual book, but to a series of four monographs on important architects, beginning with a 2003 book on Delano and Aldrich, designers of the two aforementioned clubs, that's the Knickerbocker and the Colony, continuing with an examination of Warren and Wetmore, who, despite their work on Grand Central and the Yacht Club and many important houses and office buildings, had never been the subject of a book before. And then it moves on to progressive housing reformer Grosvenor Atterbury, architect for Forest Hills Gardens and several important Manhattan townhouses, and most recently with the 2014 publication of a book on Cross and Cross, architects and real estate investors whose work, even beyond the Tiffany store, all of you are familiar with, even if you don't know it. These books were published under the direction of editor Nancy Green, first at Norton and now at Monticelli Press, with exceptional design contributed by Abigail Sturgis. Combining archival photography and exceptional new images by Jonathan Wallen that bring out the best in every building, they are exemplary introductions to important figures in New York. The architects whom Pennoyer and Walker focus on were traditionalists who looked to Europe and in some cases colonial America for precedence, adapting the architecture of the past to the needs of their contemporaries. As this traditional type of design lost favor, these architects were largely forgotten. Yet it is these very men and their contemporaries who created the residential and commercial urban streetscapes that we so revere today. The streets of brick and limestone townhouses, apartment buildings, stores, and office buildings, each hugging the lot line and all conceived with the pedestrian in mind. Penoyer and Walker deserve great credit for exhuming these relatively lost figures and giving them new life and new recognition. And so it is an honor to recognize not only these four architectural offices, but also Peter Penoyer and Ann Walker for their magnificent and important series of books, and I hope this is only the start of the series. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. There is a phenomenon that has been pointed out to me by many people, actually, that apparently a co-author begins to feel, certainly after one book, but even more so after four, that he's actually perhaps done more than 50% of the work. So we have two co-authors, and I have to say that in this case, I have no illusion. Anne has done more than her share, because I also am an architect in my day job. But our adventure together has been extraordinary. And getting to know these architects has been a revelation for me personally as an architect and an adventure for my office, since our work depends on inspiration from other generations. Cross and Cross, Grosvenor Atterbury, Warren and Wetmore, Delano and Aldrich, each one a dedicated New Yorker, and each one, as Andrew explained, left a mark on the city. And really, many of these buildings, against all odds, survive and really define many of the neighborhoods we care about. And because of her time and the research, I say, has gotten to know them personally more than I have, because she would read the love letters as well as the letters having to do with architecture. But there we go. And I also have to acknowledge our photographer, Jonathan Wallen. I have to say, traveling with Jonathan and Anne is an adventure, and it's the real research of the book, which means finding a building, looking at it, getting to know it, occasionally better than we would want. Even though this isn't a New York building, the library at Louvain is the most important monument to books created by New Yorkers at the University of Louvain. Replacing a building destroyed by Germans, the bishop insisting to the New York architect, Whitney Warren, that it be emblazoned with a Latin motto, which caused riots when it was put up, which was destroyed by Teutonic fury, rebuilt by American generosity. And we were there, we went to Louvain to photograph it, and we found a very nice professor who was associated with the university who, on a very cold Sunday, gave us complete access to the library, let us in, and locked the gate behind us. So we spent a lot of time in libraries together. And I should also mention, it's a New York building because, and this is what we love about our research, carved into the stones on the entire arcade entry level of this beautiful traditional building were the names of institutions in New York, mostly in New York, which had given money to build this library, including schools in this neighborhood, even the place we're standing in now, for all I know. So thank you for this great honor on my behalf and Anne's. We also are deeply indebted to Bob Stern, who challenged me to start this whole project with our first book on Delano and Aldrich, and who continues to this day to help guide us in our research. And as he was my professor, continues to exert what I would call the fear factor, because he reads our manuscripts and even finds time, even though he's dean of Yale, as you know, to make corrections in even the footnotes. So this is a dedicated professor. We also thank our publisher, Monticelli Press, Gianfranco Monticelli, And of course, Elizabeth White, who tonight is at the Institute of Classical Architecture and Art, receiving an Arthur Ross Award together with her husband, Sam White, for their books. I think that about sums it up. We have your gratitude, and we're honored by this jury. Thank you.
So once again, let me just say on behalf of the library that we are very proud to present these annual New York City Book Awards, and this was really one of the most special nights that we've had with this ceremony. The awards were founded in 1996. We do want to take some photographs, so all of you winners, please do not go anywhere quickly without us being able to take some photographs after. We do have books for sale if you would like to buy a book and have one of our authors sign it. The books are for sale with the Corner Books store. We'll have to ask you to go downstairs to buy the books and bring them back upstairs. We had a big crowd tonight, and this is wonderful, but you'll have to move to get your book signed. I want to once again thank Ellen Eisman for her underwriting of the awards and Jenny Lawrence for her support of the Hornblower Award. And I do want you all to feel free to stay and enjoy another glass of wine, some more refreshments. And thank you for all being here tonight and celebrating literary excellence and joining us in celebrating the great city of New York. Thank you.